Well, thank you all for coming here this evening, because if you weren't here, there'd be no point in my speaking. I want to thank a bunch of people, but I'll try and do it more briefly. I'd like to thank Richard for providing this extraordinary space. Public libraries are huge assets to a city, and this is a wonderful example of it. And I want to thank Adam both for introducing the series and also for being, I think, an inspirational green politician. I think you're incredibly lucky to have him in Australia. And I'd like to thank Joe for interviewing me and asking me pointed questions to which I had to come up with interesting answers. But he wouldn't have had the answers if he hadn't asked me the questions in that form. And as Dimitri mentioned, I want to thank Helen Tata, who, without whose intervention, I would not be here today, and we all miss her. She's a very good example of the importance of individuals. We tend to think that, you know, the world is run by machines and anonymous forces. Every so often you meet somebody, and in the publishing business, this is really important, and you think that person makes a difference. And she was one of those. And obviously, lastly, I need to thank Dimitri for getting me here and for all his wonderful hospitality so far. I'm genuinely grateful to be back in Sydney. This is my third time. Well, the title of this first talk is Who Do We Think We Are? And this, in its written version, just begins with three quotes, which I'll mention because they're kind of fun. First of all, by Protagoras, man is the measure of all things. Second, by Nietzsche, man is a rope stretched between the animal and the superman, a rope over an abyss. And thirdly, from Foucault, man could well be erased like a face drawn in sand at the edge of the sea. So who do we think we are? The last decades have witnessed a gathering skepticism about traditional humanism. The fundamental objection is that the very idea of man all too often serves as ideological cover for racial and gender and cultural or species domination. Man is a loaded term, caught up in various legitimation narratives. And yet we are a distinct species, Homo sapiens, notoriously responsible for a sharp rise in the extinction of other species on the planet. The animal man seems to have a biological reality beyond color and creed. What then can be said about the distinctive features of human beings as a species? How far can we get in giving such an account without introducing normative considerations? And as human beings ourselves, can we avoid covertly blowing our own trumpet? Consider first our inheritance. Homo sapiens is an essentially historical creature, both in ways shared by other living beings and in other distinctive ways. Homo sapiens is one of a group of hominids who survive now only as fossils. After we split from the apes some tens of millions of years ago, some 20 types of hominid followed. Australopithecus afarensis, I guess a local guy, Homo habilis and Homo erectus, the list goes on, and then we end up with Homo sapiens sapiens, modern man, itself overlapped and interbred with Homo sapiens neanderthalensis, Neanderthal man. Typically, brains got bigger, bodies got weaker as hominids succeeded one another. We evolved tool-making skills. We moved from being hunter-gatherers to farming, and now to urban life, and our diets, beliefs, and social arrangements followed suit. We're not unique as toolmakers. There are some birds, as you know, that use twigs to get insects out of trees. But our development of technology has taken tool-making to a wholly new level, dramatically affecting communication, transportation, culture, agriculture. the production of material goods, and lethal weaponry. Meanwhile, we've developed the most sophisticated and creative symbolic universe through writing, art, theater, music, film, and so on. One that almost rivals, it's almost like a second nature, rivaling the natural world in its wealth and complexity. We may be said to have realized what Taya de Chardin called the noosphere. As Freud noted, however, in his letter to Einstein in 1932, cultural restraint has not kept pace with advances in the technology of aggression. As a species, we're like kids with AK-47s. We set up institutions like the UN to bridge the gaps left by uneven development. But international cooperation is itself a tender shoot, braving heavy frosts. We don't merely have an evolutionary history, we have oral and written histories, which offer opportunities for narrative orientation, progress, decline, salutary lessons, dramatic reassessments, and inspiring examples. In an increasingly globalized world, Western grand narratives of unification are increasingly in tatters. It's harder than ever to treat Europe as taking up the Greek ideal of man and carrying its flaming torch forward, or treating America as its worthy successor. Triumphalist claims about the end of history look increasingly fatuous. In this light, it's not hard to conclude in yet another narrative that Homo sapiens is not actually smart enough to override more deeply seated instincts. But perhaps the disappointed tone implicit in this judgment is itself the problem. Human beings are an animal species, one that kills its own kind, one whose constituent members naturally favor short-term pleasures over long-term interests, despite being remarkably creative in dreaming of utopian alternatives. Surely morality is little more than a daydream, or froth on a daydream. What would a thoroughgoing naturalism look like here? We could continue to describe the practices of modern man in the same terms used by paleoanthropology, avoiding at every turn external normative judgments. That's how they get food. That's how they mate, communicate, provide for their own shelter and security, care for their young. And these are their ritual activities, their ceremonies, their belief systems. Millennia from now, we might add, and this is why they died out, or why they were succeeded by Homo modesto, a smaller, less aggressive human. Such a naturalism would be totally unsentimental. The sixth great extinction of other species on the planet would be but a blip in the ongoing adventure of life that would eventually move forward and flourish in unexpected ways. But surely such a naturalism harbors a deep contradiction. Its very lack of sentiment is an achievement worthy of an Olympian god. Humans are indeed wholly natural beings, and yet they or we have introduced into nature something utterly remarkable, a reflective and symbolic capacity that can indeed be directed to serving pre-existing instinctual ends, but which equally can address the bigger picture that's now emerging. The promise of reason may well have been hijacked by its bastard son, calculation, but when Hume wrote, "Reason is and ought only to be a slave of the passions," he forgot to include the passion for truth and justice. On the question of whether these are just froth, the jury is still out. There have been tipping points in human understanding, points marked by names such as Copernicus, Darwin, Kant, Marx, Freud. Freud himself called Copernicus, Darwin, and psychoanalysis, and I quote, "wounds to the human psyche." In each case, a certain understanding of human sovereignty has been shown to be an illusion, or at least the product of covert forces. In each case, we've had to unlearn habitual topological schemas, displacing the earth from the center of things, accepting that the world as we experience it is not just there, but cognitively shaped by us in deep ways, that we form a continuum with other non-human life forms with whom we share an evolutionary history, that human history has been shaped by those who owned the means of production, and that our normal reflective grasp of ourselves is a delicate achievement, masking the work of the unconscious and drives we would rather not acknowledge. What Nietzsche called the death of God, and Foucault the death of man, and the French Soixante-Huitard, the guys who were alive in the, usually guys in the 68 period, more generally called the death of the subject, all these testify to this composite new dawn. If it didn't resurrect a discredited enlightenment or an enlightenment narrative, it would be tempting to call this progress. And indeed, there are many, especially but not including, not exclusively religious fundamentalists, who would dispute that one or other of these displacements, like the death of the subject or the death of man, really does constitute progress. Apart from Darwin, these are changes, transformations, displacements within human history. What I'm calling geological consciousness displaces human history itself, relocating it not just within the history of life, within the normally slow-moving history of the geological. The Anthropocene marks significant human impact on the atmosphere, the oceans, the ice caps, raising the average temperature of the Earth's surface, bringing change to what we thought we could take for granted. For the most part, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, tsunamis, and hurricanes are local phenomena. Things eventually return to normal. But the Anthropocene is global and, for all intents and purposes, irreversible. For all its unprecedented material impact, its significance can perhaps be drawn within an even deeper shift in human consciousness, the end of human sovereignty with respect to nature. It's not that we don't have power or that we can't subject some piece of the natural world to our will, if only temporarily. We can. I mean, crop yields have risen. Antibiotics save lives. And we've learned many ways to extract oil and coal from the earth, including blowing the tops off mountains. But we cannot or do not control the blowback consequences of these efforts. Water pollution, soil impoverishment, decimation of bee populations, antibiotic resistance, the list goes on. What our production processes would like to think of as externalities come back to bite us. We cannot control, as we would like, the various ways we nourish and poison nature to serve our ends. Our desire for control is out of control. Within Christianity, greener evangelicals, distinctly a minority, have been pushing for a revision of the translation of the influential passage in Genesis that speaks of man's dominion over nature, replacing it with stewardship or creation care. For all its limits, this is another indication of a profound shift from what Mick Smith has called ecological sovereignty. We don't have a fancy name for this shift, but it's arguably quite as important as any of the others. It doesn't mean that we humans should give up trying to work with the natural world to meet our needs and pleasures, but that we need to jettison any sense that it's there for us. I had a man doing work on my house once, an electrician, and I was chatting with him about climate change by his truck as he was leaving, and he said, "David, nature is my bitch. I will do with her as I will." This is... He was also a Christian musician. I was actually very grateful for the quote, I have to say, but not for the content. And hence, any sense that we can do anything we like to it, and that there will always be more, and that there will be no lasting repercussions. Bruno Latour's recent attempts to defend Lovelock's Gaia hypothesis, according to which the Earth is a living organism, follow just such a path, stripping out all teleology, all political theology, as he calls it. A Gaia-centric perspective would certainly displace an anthropocentric one. The sovereignty question relates not just to nature in general, but to the ways in which we treat non-human animal life. As we know, there are still those who resist the idea of evolution for religious reasons and who understand the biblical story of creation literally. Until I lived in the American South, I did not know that this was still possible for an educated public. It seems that some schools give equal time to the creation theory. What it reflects is a genuine anxiety about what it is to be human. There's a line that mustn't be crossed. And I recall that one gentleman at the famous Scopes trial, also known as the Monkey Trial, in Dayton, Tennessee, which is the state I live in 1925, objected to the teaching of evolution in the following terms. He says, "I don't have a problem being descended from monkeys, but fish, that's something I can't accept." Something of this anxiety, though without the fish, seems to rear its head in Heidegger's reference to our scarcely conceivable abyssal bodily kinship with the beast. Now, I'm not going to pursue here the details of Heidegger's account or comments on it by Derrida or Agamben, nor Agamben's elaboration of what he calls the anthropological machine, the extended theoretical apparatus by which we define man by exclusion and subjugation of the animal. That we do this seems incontestable. Why we do this is an open question. Whether we can break out of what Derrida once called our carno-phalagocentrism, an extraordinary word, remains to be seen. There seem to be some obvious ideological explanations for maintaining this boundary, this man-animal boundary, any one of which may have a depth as yet unplumbed. And it's worth reminding ourselves that the scope and scale of this war on the animal almost defies the imagination. Derrida, along with Coetzee and Patterson, is driven to compare the full animal exploitation program to the worst genocides. Our sense of sovereignty justifies a carnivorous diet. It legitimates human territorial expansion that drives other species to extinction as merely collateral damage. It sustains our sense of sovereignty, sustains racial oppression and the oppression of women. Once these classes of humans are successfully linked to animal characteristics, for example, valued for their bodies, we can more easily exploit them. I went to a cafe once driving through Montana, and there was this table mat in front of me, and it depicted an outline of a naked woman with all her parts labeled as meat cuts. Finally, the control, and this was like, and the waitress came up, you know, she seemed perfectly happy with this. Finally, the control and subjugation of animals may be a ritual, productive enactment of what civilization demands we do to our animal passions, especially for violence and sex. On this account, we reinforce our separation from and control over the animal part of ourselves by externalizing the drama into a relation with actual animals. We need for there to be a human-animal abyss to motivate our own control over ourselves. Exploring deep time, geological time, reopens the whole question of what kind of animal we are, how we are animal, how we can embrace becoming animal, whether there's a case for any kind of human exceptionalism, and so on. For brevity's case, let me venture some remarks without the justification that it really needs. First, deconstructing or breaking apart the human-animal divide can take many forms. First, Nietzsche's genealogy of morals ties morality back to asceticism, to the inflicting of pain, and inter alia connects all of this to the establishing of memory and identity as making possible the moral internalization that will sicken the human animal. Freud would call this the history of repression. Both Nietzsche and later Marcuse will argue that this is surplus repression and that civilization will not collapse if the restrictions are eased. Second, the divide can be contested by showing that every defining difference fails the test. You want to know what the difference is between humans and animals? Come up with one criteria after another, they all fail. And where it matters, our capacity to suffer, we're all in the same boat. Derrida applies such a treatment to Heidegger's insistence that animals cannot die, just perish. They have no grasp of their own mortality. And one strand of Derrida's response to that is to say, well, what grasp do we have of our mortality? Do we really have a clear concept of our death? Thirdly, the divide can be softened or breached by focusing on the unsuspecting depth and complexity of our actual communication, engagement, and relationships with other creatures. And I'm thinking here of books by like Mark Bikoff, The Emotional Lives of Animals, Donna Haraway's book, When Species Meet, Vicky Hearn's book, Adam's Task, and Jane Goodall's works with chimps. Much of what this work demonstrates is that the language that we humans use to describe these connections is absolutely central. So lastly, biological research. The results of genetic research so far demonstrate surprising genetic proximity between humans and our closest animal neighbors, with gene sharing coming in at, well, with chimps it's 98%, gorillas only a bit less at 96%, mice 92%. It's hard to believe, anyway, and high levels for most mammals. This, in fact, shouldn't be surprising, given what we know about our evolutionary heritage. But in fact, these figures are a bit misleading. The possession of genes is one thing, but their arrangement is surely another. The 2% gap between us and chimps may be critical. Quantitative comparisons are much too crude. What evolutionary biology and neuroanatomy helpfully teaches us is to recognize that some of our behaviors reflect inheritances from older or previous creatures. What's sometimes called our reptilian brain refers to those brain structures, I think in the basal ganglia, responsible for aggression, territoriality, and ritual behavior. When we look at the continuing human willingness to go to war, we may well wonder, whether the conquest and social sublimation or diversion of instinct doesn't remain a top priority. The first and the last of these ways of deconstructing the human-animal binary are the most relevant for rethinking geological time. And as it happens, each of them leaves us with more questions than answers. So I'd like now to return to my cataloguing, however gesturally, of something of the history of mankind's greatest shocks to its self-understanding. In its unavoidable materiality and unprecedented scale, the Anthropocene needs to be understood within this sequence, not just because of its overflowing human history into the geological, but because it's intimately connected with global warming and the sixth extinction. These connections should make it impossible for us to treat the Anthropocene as mere spectators. Finally, as a chapter in this end of ecological sovereignty story, we must make mention of the human microbiome. I don't know, this is like recent stuff for me, but it's mind-blowing. The Human Microbiome Project, launched in 2007, is revealing just how much of the human body is, you don't have to listen to this, this is disturbing, is made of foreign organisms whose balance is necessary to our health, including, for each of us, 20 trillion bacteria. This can be expected to spark a revolution in medicine and in the broader ways that we think about us. I've just mentioned the bacteria. I mean, they're creatures in my eyebrow. They're like really, really small, like Tyrannosaurus rexes. I mean, you know, I've learned to live with them. But as a metastasizing metaphor to rethink the fragility and multiplicity and permeability of self, and the primacy of cooperation over conflict. Because when we're healthy, this crowd that is me is getting on, cooperating. So I'm saying that kind of a good model for how we might relate to the other in other contexts, both our own kind, our descendants, and indeed other species. Could the microbiome revolution not bring about an evolutionary twist in the story of man that would change everything? These displacements, old and new, each reflect dramatic shifts in human consciousness. But we must be cautious about interpreting this claim, especially today. What I'm calling a dramatic shift in human consciousness may initially be spread thinly or unevenly, and a new grasp of the cooperative interdependence or interconnectedness of life and the folly of the sovereignty model may coexist indefinitely with the productive and destructive practices of yesteryear. If, as seems clear, these practices are driven by economic forces whose raison d'etre remains intact, an alternative, even widespread, dissenting consciousness may have little more impact than rain on the palace windows. So who do we think we are? The history of our self-understanding has been a roller coaster of traumatic displacements. Are we, as a result, equipped to deal with our current situation? What is to be done? Environmental engagement's been plagued by a sense of futility. The facts are in, but what to do? Reason doesn't seem to be calling the shots. One explanation could be derived from Hume when he claims, as I mentioned before, that reason is and ought only to be a slave to the passions. But that raises the question, which passions? If we understand passions in the broadest affective way, the question would morph into how reason can best do justice to these passions. And are there other passions than despair? Being geologically human, what could that mean? At first blush, it addresses the question of whether there's an adequate or appropriate response or type of response to our increasingly cosmic grasp of our terrestrial situation. That grasp has many facets, from science, new information, and new paradigms, as well as pressing urgencies, but also new and some old responses. So we've seen that from science, we're the children of Copernicus, Darwin, and Freud, but also Georges Lemaître with Big Bang Theory, Watson and Crick with DNA and genetics, and an increasingly rich historical understanding of our place in nature. We've come to see ourselves as species with products of extraordinary natural forces, operating at many levels over countless millennia, continuous and yet not quite continuous with the rest of life. We've constructed stories about these events, even as the timescales involved boggle the imagination. Most importantly, we've invented new paradigms to understand the times we live in, paradigms that take us out of human history, as we said, into the geological, and certainly into the history of nature. So I'm thinking here of sixth extinction, something like 50 to 150 species going extinct every day. Secondly, the Anthropocene, a term first used in the year 2000 by Paul Crutzen, the period in which human activities become the dominant influence on climate and the environment on this planet. And third, global warming, which is a gradual increase in the Earth's average surface temperature caused, as most people believe, by human activity. Associated with these new paradigms, there's a growing sense of the very real possibility of what we might call the end of man. We know this will happen, literally, on or before about 3.5 billion years down the road, when it seems that the sun will swallow up the Earth in a fiery conflagration. So if you've got stuff to do, get it done before that happens. But somewhat sooner, it seems, as if a dramatic change in the fortunes of the human species is on the cards, even within the century, which could certainly spell the end of a certain dream or hope, which we variously call enlightenment, justice, peace, basically generalized flourishing. Mass migration, displacement, catastrophic weather changes, disease, crop failure, starvation are all predicted, all on the heels of electric cars, better iPhones, gene therapy, and so on. What we might call geological consciousness is inseparable from what we have long called cosmic consciousness, which itself takes various forms, from a sense of infinite connectedness to awe on looking up at the stars. And yet there's been a change from a dialectic of oneness and distance, more characteristic of this cosmic consciousness, to what we might call geological anxiety of accountability, each of them operating under the umbrella of a certain sense of finitude. And here, perhaps, again, we can return to Hume and the broader question of our passions. Connectedness and awe are just examples of the passions that animate a geologically alive being. The role of the passions here is vital, if only because of the rightfully magnetic power of the everyday, the space in which we live, move, and earn our living, the space from which, I quote, the witty and attractive Thracian girl, servant girl, is said to have mocked Thales for falling into a well while he was observing the stars and gazing upwards, declaring that he was eager to know the things in the sky, but that what was behind him and just by his feet escaped his notice. This is the man, however, who subsequently predicted a solar eclipse. Not so stupid. If there were such a thing as geophenomenology, a serious acknowledgement of the constitutive power of such passions would be part of its remit. And I'd like briefly to gesture in this direction by glossing, in addition to angst or anxiety, three distinct responses: wonder, curiosity, and delight. How far are we doing? The question, why does anything exist rather than nothing, can be posed formally. But it surely has its roots in the interrogative experience of wonder, which Socrates called the only beginning of philosophy, and Descartes called the first of all the passions. Unlike Plato, Descartes thought of wonder as a gateway or stimulus to science, which, much like Wittgenstein's ladder, could be set aside once it had served its purpose. I think this is too harsh. Wonder needn't impede science. Moreover, if wonder is independent of the geological, it takes on a distinct flavor when it's filled out geologically. When Brian Swim describes the Big Bang and its primal fire as, and I quote, an explosion of energy powerful enough to send all matter flying apart for billions of years into the future, a fire that's a billion trillion times hotter than the center of the sun, he sounds like a child who's discovered the giddiness of big numbers. I think he's giving voice to wonder, running up against the limits of language and imagination while still needing to press words into service. In the Three Metamorphoses, Nietzsche wrote of the lion that can destroy but cannot create value. The dislocating power of wonder is not enough, but it may be just such a passion that can both break with the everyday and yet stick around subsequently to infuse the space that it opens onto with coherence and significance. It's for just such ongoing infusive power that Irigaray, the French philosopher Irigaray, tries to redirect cosmic wonder towards wonder at the sexual other. She thinks it's not the cosmos first, it's the sexual other. That's how wonder begins. Now, if I had not had the jaw-dropping experience of staring into the Grand Canyon at the age of 10, gobsmacked at the exposed sedimentary strata, a mile deep, carved by the Colorado River over hundreds of thousands of years before there was any Colorado, I might have been seduced by her suggestion. As it was, as it is, I was bitten with a geological wonder that cannot be reassigned. So the second one, that's talking about wonder. How about curiosity? Is this really a passion? Heidegger comes down hard on curiosity, along with ambiguity and gered, or chat, for its a superficial lack of engagement. But this is too harsh. Perhaps I'm signaling deep curiosity rather than Heidegger's endless flitting. I mean something like the passion for understanding, for truth, fashionable doubts notwithstanding. Consider this. I find a spearhead, at the end of my field, somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 years old. I want to know all about it. Which tribe made it? How they attached it to the spear? What they hunted? What happened to them? Perhaps what they thought of when they looked up at the stars. What this land looked like then. Then I walk on and I find a large slab of limestone on which are etched coral fossils from about 450 million years ago. That's 200 million years before the dinosaurs. Yes, there's wonder again. And it provokes imagination. I'm told this was once a shallow sea. That's why this is all limestone. What would it have been like to be here then? What else was flourishing? I want to know. This is indeed where science takes off. And it's just something like wonder that can protect science against being drawn into the economy of control and exploitation, or an offshoot of the will to power. How things work, how they arose, how they interconnect, the passion for knowledge is for many unquenchable and not reducible to Nietzsche's analysis. When it comes to the earth and its sciences, from geology and geography to paleontology and archaeology, this thirst explores origins and options. It tests our imagination and it opens ever more questions. In particular, it keeps nudging up against questions of meaning as local intelligibility ripples out into expanding circles of successful explanation that never quite shed and sometimes intensify the question, why? The earth sciences continuously test this edge, focused on the earth, exposed to the cosmos, giving substance to wonder. And lastly, delight. Consider the paintings of birds by 19th century naturalist John J. Audubon. They are accurate, but they're also works of delight. Delight at the variety of the natural world, capturing birds in poses, reflecting their trademark activities. Delight here is attention to detail, rather than focusing on limits and deep meaning. It suspends such issues, and one could treat such attention as a response to the aporetic turmoil of the big questions, while preserving the wonder that scientific curiosity risks evaporating. But we should now say one more thing about angst. Kant, the philosopher Kant, understood what he called the dynamical sublime as one in which we feel fearful without being afraid of the object, that is nature, that causes it. The dynamical sublime is, as he put it, nature considered in aesthetic judgment as might that has no dominance over us. Such as the experience of watching a storm as the sort you had a few days ago from the safety of your window. Our contemporary equivalent might be watching a disaster movie in the safety of a cinema. The big idea is that a powerful experience can provoke an awareness in us of the even power, a greater power, of human reason. I want to suggest that we think of the experience of the sublime rather as a class of various experiences of the overwhelming. This would include, for example, Pascal's comment on looking up at the stars, that, I quote, the eternal silence of these infinite spaces frightens me. It would include Heidegger's account of angst, of das Nichts, captured by the sense that things as a whole are slipping away. And it would capture one of Nietzsche's accounts of how we might respond to the eternal return. What each of these versions of the anxious sublime share with Kant's account is a certain reflexive resonance. The experience is not just directed to its object, it reflexively engages the subject, even to the point of discombobulation. There's nothing quite like Derrida's account of 9/11 to bring this out. After making clear what a real tragedy it was, he focuses on our inability to properly name the event, assigning it rather a number or a date, 9/11. We like to think of it as an incursion, an attack on America from the outside, in line with the topology of Reagan's Star Wars missile defense system, which would have functioned like a virtual glass dome over America. Inside the dome, we'd be safe from our enemies. We were told 9/11 was unforeseen and couldn't have been predicted. And yet, he points out, this is Derrida, points out, the terrorists trained in America. Their leader, bin Laden, was himself trained by the U.S. in Afghanistan to fight the Soviets. Their recruits were largely drawn from one of our allies, Saudi Arabia. They used American airports and American planes. The distinction, the neat distinction between inside and outside is seriously blurred. Was it unpredictable? Well, apparently it was repeatedly predicted by security analysts. Our sense of security, a fantasy to begin with, was indeed shattered. But the difficulty of naming 9/11 and the insistence that it be referred to on every public occasion in the days and weeks afterwards reflected the chaos that it wreaked on our categories, our security at a deeper level. For Derrida, however, this is not all. Linked to the breach in our sense of safety was what 9/11 portended. If that could happen, what might the future hold? We'd be foolish to underestimate the terrorists' imagination. This seems to me to be a concrete case of angst, of things as a whole slipping away. For many observers, there was again a deep sense that the reactive nature of the US response, going to war against a constructed enemy, was an even greater source of unease. The terrorists really had been successful in choreographing our place in their drama, displaying writ large the strategic incompetence of our leadership, the folly of our failure to redefine the space of engagement, and so on. Sadly, such a reactive response was indeed predictable and predicted, and its tragedy far worse than the original event. To put it crudely, it wouldn't be far-fetched to conclude after Rwanda, after Hurricane Katrina, and now perhaps after Syria, that the quality and character of Western leadership is intellectually, technically, and morally ill-equipped to deal with world-shattering disaster. And going forward, it's not clear how this might change. Pascal's remark about looking up at the stars might be thought to be voicing cosmic angst. It's a confession that our understanding has encountered something it cannot ignore but cannot handle. What we might call geological angst, a common response to the significance of the sixth extinction, the Anthropocene, or global warming, is not so different. But there's more going on here. The gap between acknowledging a powerful, perhaps overwhelmingly powerful, phenomenon and being able to deal with it intellectually is one thing. Understandably, so to speak, one could be drawn to a religious resolution, humbly admitting one's finitude. But geological angst has another dimension, one brought out by Derrida's account of 9/11. As the cartoon figure Pogo put it, we have met the enemy, and he is us. For those with an irredeemably upbeat sense of man's mission on Earth, this is seriously disconcerting. And some simply go into denial. But for those with a more chastened vision, the angst comes from the agonizing gap between comprehension and agency. We understand ourselves to be responsible, and yet we believe either that it's too late to prevent catastrophe, whether for us, our descendants, or for much of the rest of life, or we can see exactly how current trends can be reversed, but we cannot see how these solutions could be politically, economically, or socially implemented in current circumstances. Each of these responses animates agency-driven angst. What is to be done, we cry. Nietzsche's account of alternative responses to the news of the eternal return is instructive here. You are told, imagine you are told, the eternal hourglass of existence is turned upside down again and again, and you with it, speck of dust. Would you not throw yourself down and gnash your teeth and curse the demon who spoke thus? Option one. Or have you once experienced a tremendous moment when you would have answered him, you are a god, and never have I heard anything more divine. If this thought gained possession of you, it would change you as you are, or perhaps crush you. Much reaction to Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, was of the gnashing of teeth variety. Okay, so the glaciers in Tibet are disappearing. What am I supposed to do? Nietzsche's scenario is oddly comforting. It seems, at least, as though the possibility of ecstatic affirmation is at hand, up to me, if I can find the right attitude. But geologically, the angst just piles up. I'd be willing to change, but it's pointless unless most other people do too. And the problems are structural, they're endemic. I hope it will be clearer why I've been focusing on the affective. The most common response at this point is resignation or token activism. The university students at East Anglia in England last year decided to start peeing in the shower to save water. The green badge, I guess. Or quiet despair. We're perhaps talking about what Heidegger would call mood, deep ways of shaping and coloring our being in the world. And if the immediate provocation is the recognition of our geological responsibility, there's a rippling out effect that's equally disturbing. Realizing that it's not a matter of individual agency, after all, neither I nor any particular person is responsible for the Industrial Revolution or carbon capitalism or the commodification of the earth, when we turn to the possibility of collective action and a collective response, hope dims more broadly, both because it's clear that democratic decision-making has been fatally compromised by other interests, and because there's no guarantee at all that a true democracy, whatever that means, would make better decisions. After all, the people in Nietzsche's market square wanted the entertainer. They wanted the tightrope walker. They didn't want Zarathustra the prophet. I've got another couple of minutes, then I'm almost there. You want more? I can do more. All this is to say that the space that unfurls when we expand Kant's dynamical sublime or give substance to Heidegger's angst is much more complex than sitting behind a window watching a storm raging outside. It's one in which the reflexive dimension through which the experience turns back on us can come to preoccupy us. If at times this turns into dispiriting irresolution, such as pessimism, the true hope of something like angst, strangely enough, is that it doesn't get cathected, as with fear, into some sort of token and inappropriate object, but rather keeps open the possibility of other creative responses. I'm taking our passions seriously, not because they're the ultimate drivers of change, but because once aroused, they can come to block or inspire transformation. And reflection on their underlying conditions can direct attention to what more basic problems need to be addressed. Nietzsche's account of ressentiment or resentment is a case in point. What then of Hume's claim that reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions? Well, it's just not that simple, especially when our passions conflict and when they're intimately bound up with what reason concludes from trying dispassionately to make sense of the world. Sometimes our passions need re-educating. It's perhaps a sorry token of the generally downbeat tone of this first lecture. it's meant positively. That I turn to angst for hope, for keeping possibilities open. I'm tapping into Heidegger's strange but persuasive idea that to be truly at home in the world, we must experience something of the uncanny, the unheimlich. But there's no doubting the weight of history that opens up when we begin to think geologically. We seem to be faced by layers of intractability that threaten our ability to move forward in a life-affirming way. This itself could be deadly. Nietzsche was faced with just this problem at the level of human history when in 1874 he wrote his essay, The Uses and Disadvantages of History for Life. And next time, on Wednesday, I will explore how we might adapt his creative suggestions to a geological timescale in surprising ways.